Hi, everybody. As I put on, I mentioned on Facebook, I have been, for reasons absolutely beyond me, been put on temporary Facebook jail so that I can't do a live video. But nothing stops the power of Torah. Nothing's going to stop me, certainly. It's only for 2 days, but I want to make sure that the shiur is on time. You'll recall what Shammai said, "Aseh Torah Hakeva." One of the meanings of that, or one of the interpretations that's given for that, is that you have to make sure that when you have a time to study Torah, you absolutely never, you don't cancel it, you don't move it, you don't. It's there, and that's where it is, and you make sure you have it, and so on. And our keva is for right now. Our keva is for 1 o'clock on Monday. All right, so we're starting a little bit late. I couldn't help it. I had to set up my my stuff in the office, but I'm not going to any way, shape, or form give up on our Torah time together. And let's go. Andiamo, as they say in Italian. Let's go. The with the beginnings of the with this new Mishnah. The structure of the first parak in Avot changes. Up until now, we have seen the series of Mishnayot, the series of statements by the leading scholars of their generation from the time of the return to Eretz Yisrael, the return to Zion around the year 532 BCE with the with the declaration of Koresh, which allowed for Jews to leak, go from Babylonia back to Eretz Yisrael and to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. The first group was the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, who were the religious and administrative authority in Eretz Yisrael in the first part of the Second Temple period. And then we went on to the last members of Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, and then to the Zugot, to the pairs of scholars who were at the who were the Chachmei HaMasoret, the Chachmei Torah Shebal Peh, the representatives of the oral law, as opposed to Sadducees and others. There were other denominations, let's call it, of Judaism at the time, but the one that Rabbinic Judaism is descended from, and which history vindicated, and which those of us who are Orthodox believe God achieved or guaranteed their vindication, what we call Pharisees, Sofrim, and so on, until we get to Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai were the last of these pairs, when the first one was the head of the Sanhedrin, or the organization, or the institution of Torah Sheval Peh, and the second one, the Av Beit Din, the head of the court, the person who did the Rasmor, was born for, he was associate head, or the head of the of the actual Batei Din, whatever the case might be. And then there's a jump. At that point, the rest of the Mishnah no longer sort of plays out or no longer traces down the leadership, but rather stays within the family of Hillel. The reason for this is very simple. For whatever reason, and we really don't know why, or I don't know why, Hillel and Shammai were the last pairs. At the time of Hillel's death, the leadership of the Chachmei HaTorah Shebal Peh, the sages of the oral law, and their followers in, don't forget the temple's still around, that leadership went exclusively to the house of Hillel. So Hillel's son, grandson, great-grandson, and so on and so forth, all the way down to the end of what's called the Patriarchate, the Nisiut, the one person who was in charge of the of representing Judaism in the land of Israel, which whose position was actually ended by the Romans in 425 CE. In other words, talking for another 425 years or so, was exclusively in the hands of the descendants of Hillel. So for the rest of the parak, we're just going to be tracing down descendants of Hillel who served in the Nisiut. Now, Shammai didn't go away. I mean, Shammai passed away. But his students and followers founded a school which was in constant, at constant loggerheads with Beit Hillel. It was called Beit Shammai, and a large swath of the traditions of Torah Sheba'al Peh record many differences of agreement, differences of opinion between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, when in fact these houses reflect the overall philosophies of law and outlooks of their founders. So the Hillel is a lot more, the House of Hillel tends to be more lenient, tends to be, I don't want to use the word liberal because it's really not appropriate here, tends to be more lenient, tends to be more open, tends to be more flexible in interpretation, whereas the House of Shammai, like as was the case with Shammai, are much more strict constructionist, if you want to use a term from American constitutional law, more conservative, and as a result, more machmir, because you have less give. Now, that doesn't mean that they were consistently either one way or the other. There were many, many, many places where Beit Hillel is far more severe, far stricter than Beit Shammai and the Hefech. So, anyways, that's the structure. So the next person that with whom we were going to have what to do is Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel here is the grandson of Hillel. Hillel's son's name was Shimon. Rabban Gamliel was Hillel's grandson. It's not that unusual to find that a grandson actually inherits or becomes the major next stage of a dynasty. I'll give you an example. In the Hasidut of Ger, for example, the founder of Hasidut Ger was Rabbi Yitzchak Meir of Gur, who was a Talmud of the Rebbe of Kotsk. And at the same time, his son, or actually not that young, but his son did not really leave a mark on Ger, and the next major figure is the grandson, whose name was Rabbi Yaleib, who's known for his profound and amazing books of thought, which are known as the Sfat Emet, the language of truth. In any case, so the next Mishnah we have to deal is formulated by Rabban Gamliel ben Shimon ben Hillel. That's a long way of introducing this second half of the parak. So. Rabbi Gamliel starts and says the following: Aseh lecha rav, vistalek ma'asafek, va'al tarbeh le'emod umadot. La'aser umadot, sorry. Va'al tarbeh la'aser umadot. Aseh lecha rav, make yourself a teacher. Now that's an injunction that we have had before. We had it in the sixth Mishnah. Yeshua ben Prachya said that. So the question is, why does he have to repeat it? We'll come back to that. Next, Bistalek Ba'asafek, and avoid or run away from doubt. And most people put the two together, say if you have a Rav and you have a doubt, so you'll go to the Rav and he'll put you straight and you won't have a problem with that. Ba'al tarbel la'aser umadot, don't, when you do your tithing, don't do it based on estimation. By what it looks like, but rather be very precise in your tithes. We'll explain that, not today. I have a suspicion we're not going to get to this for a while because I want to spend a lot of time talking about Aseh lecha rav and what's the fake and what's doubt in Jewish thought and is doubt a legitimate religious category and stuff like that. But we will get to it, and it's an interesting question. Why, you know, it sort of seems like out of left field. I mean, you're talking about big, important issues like having a teacher and what does that mean to have a teacher and so on. And then the question of doubt and is doubt a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And so on. And then you got this like little halacha. I mean, so, you know, why? So we will, please God, get to that. Aseh lecha rav. Let's start at the beginning. I called this year picking a teacher, a rav or a rabbanit. A male or a teacher, a female teacher, it really doesn't matter. Today having a female, a learned woman, a Talmidah Chachama, as one's Rav is a possibility. It wasn't something that was available earlier. It's not unprecedented. the famous story of Chacham Barazani, who was the Rosh Hashiva in Kabul in Afghanistan. But our situation is different. So, you know, Asei L'charav or Asei L'charavanit. Establish yourself, find yourself a teacher. Now, that's not such a... The first question has to be asked is, we did that already. We, as I said, we saw this. Why mention this? Why do I need to know this again? So, the truth of the matter is that all the Meforshim, all the commentaries sit there and say, why do I need this twice? And in typical fashion, they try to resolve it dialectically. What do you mean dialectically? Since we don't allow for contradictions or for duplications or for extra things in our sacred literature, so every single statement must have some meaning. Now, that is rooted already in Chumash. If you have, the Torah tells you something twice. Well, why would the Torah tell you something twice? Isn't once enough? God said, do X. God said, don't do X. God said, this happened or this happened. Why do I need to know it more? Why do I hear it more than once? And that actually is in the context of the Bible, that's actually a theological issue. Because there is a statement which was presented by the 10th century philosopher, Rav Sadia Gaon, in Babylonia. He originally was from Egypt. They went to Israel, came to Babylonia in the early part of the 10th century. Who said, God and nature do nothing in vain. It's not possible for God to do something which is worthless, of no meaning. God, it just doesn't go. God by definition is purposefulness. So therefore, if there's an extra verse and it looks like you don't need it, it must have a reason, because God doesn't do things just like that. I'd like to call attention to the fact that God and nature do nothing in vain. Nature doesn't do anything in vain either. That's something that part of the statement he picked up from Greek philosophy. We often make that mistake. God created the universe. God created nature. And we have this attitude of, oh, who needs this? And why do we need that? And you know, our attitude towards the environment is extremely, or until recently, extremely cavalier. And as a result, we cut down the rainforest. We did this other stuff as if that was an obstacle, as if it was some kind of thing to get around, and now we're only discovering that every single thing in the universe has a purpose, and we pay a price when we play with it. We pay a price when we mix and match. We pay a price when we play genetic master and creator. We pay a price, all kinds of prices. So God and nature, nothing in vain. You should not take a cavalier attitude towards nature either. Kal vachomer, all the more so, if you find something that God said it twice, so there must be a reason. So the assumption is that the rabbis, when they formulated their words, tried to imitate God and to be very careful in what they said and not to say things that were totally superfluous. So therefore, if the same thing appears twice, so there must be a reason. There are different ways of resolving this kind of thing, and they're usually called dialectic. What's dialectic? Dialectic means that there really is no superfluity here. It's not extra. And there can't be a contradiction either, because by definition, God can't contradict himself, and we try not to formulate and put contradictions into our words either. So how do you resolve such things? You do it dialectically. What do you mean dialectically? Dialectic means both sides are right, both things are right, or the extra state, both statements are necessary. We just have to understand what they are coming to teach us. So most of the commentaries, when they discuss this question of why is the assertion or the demand, Asei L'charav, why does it come up more than once? So the answer that's usually given is that they both refer to different types of things. There's a long trend among commentators that the first time this appears is that you should never, ever rely on your own authority. You should really study with other people. Even if the people are less than you, they can actually criticize you. They can give you input. They can point out where you may be wrong, or maybe where your logic was faulty. They may know things that maybe very likely do know things that you don't know, which can only enrich you. And that's on the one hand. On the other hand, the second one, the one that we're talking about now, the second, the Asei L'charav, does not so much refer to the process of study, but the process of deciding halakha. It's a question of authority. Who has the right to pasken? So the answer is, who has the right to decide the issues of Jewish law? For there you need a rav. Now, that's going to be a very large issue. What does that mean to have a rav? But you need to have an authority that you follow. You can't just decide things on your own. And in fact, especially that is true of things which touch you most most closely. As Caesar said to the petitioners as he was walking into the Senate, that which touches us the most dear shall be treated last. As Chazal say, "Ein adam ruah nigayatzmo." A person should not pasken shilas for themselves, because they're an interested party. They can't be objective. They may very well get it wrong, because their judgment might be clouded. So you should actually outsource or find somebody you can rely on in Pesach. So that distinction between study on the one hand and religious authority on the other, in terms of legal decisions, is one way of looking at it. Other people say no. The first one means you should have good friends, or you should way after the second vaccine. So if anybody's worried, there's nothing to worry about. The first one is talking in general. You know, when you study, you should go to study with the person who's the expert. Don't stop at the lowest level. Don't just take the easy way out. If you want to know something well, you go to the master and you learn from the master, because you do it the best way possible. And so that's sort of a general, generic kind of statement. Others say, but when Rabbi Gamliel, who is the head of the Sanhedrin, when he is talking, he's talking about a rabbi. Find yourself a rabbi. Find yourself a person who can teach you Torah, who's got authority, and don't just be loose about it. Okay, so that's another way. I have my own interpretation, and I think it's not all that different, or at least I think it bespeaks the other concerns that I've mentioned in the interpretations. I think that what happened over here is that the fact that over the course of 200 years, it had to be reiterated, Aseh lecha rav, choose yourself a rabbi, that there was consistent need that didn't go away, that people were not doing that. In other words, if you find, historically speaking, for example, if you find for example, communities in the Middle Ages used to enact all kinds of legislation for the public good, more for morality, for religious standards, for all kinds of stuff. And very often you find that communities will continue to reenact laws that you would have thought maybe that was only relevant then and not now. Now, one could say that maybe they're just endorsing everything that everybody came before, but it's not always the case. In other words, if you find that the community has to keep mentioning that we have a problem and we have to address this problem and this has to be dealt with and so on, that may very well be, and often is, an indication that this is a matter of concern which has not ceased to be a matter of concern. So, if that's the situation, I would suggest that there was a serious issue. That rabbis in the Mishnah kept saying, you have to pick a rav, you have to pick a teacher. Now, why would that be the case? It may very well be that you have here a statement of practicality. Simply a question of practicality. And this is sort of hinted at in a lot of the commentaries. We're talking about a situation in which, or a period in which, people are studying by heart. The only written books are the Tanakh. And in fact, at this stage of the ballgame, the last section, their final decision had not been reached yet as to whether, as to which book should be included in the Ketuvim in the last part of the Bible. In other words, there hadn't been a judgment. There had been no decision made about Shir HaShirim. There had been no decision made about Kohelet. This was going to wait, this was going to wait 50, 60 years after Rabbi Gamliel, the first. He's not Rabbi Gamliel, it's Zakeim, the elder. And not yet. So the books are around, but, you know, even there, you don't even know what's authoritative. So what everybody agreed on was Chumash and the Nevi'im and the prophets. Good. But that's all that's written. Everything else is oral. So it's not like I can go into a bookstore today and pull out a book and I can read it. If I want to have a Jewish education, I need to go to somebody who knows all of the oral traditions and all of the stories and all of the agadot and all of the interpretations. And in a period of dynamic interpretation where people are creating new insights constantly, which later will become the Talmud, I become totally dependent on a Rav. I think what we're talking about is that the Prushim here, that the rabbis here, rabbis is anachronistic, the title rabbi only comes up out, starts being used after the destruction of the temple. But the need to find responsible teachers is even greater when things are still oral. Because there's no quality, what kind of quality control could there be? So you need to be able to find a person upon whom you can rely, that they have the right creds, that they studied with the right people, that you know that they're responsible in the transmission of tradition. All of these things are very, very, very important. And so Aseh Lecha Rav, pick somebody who's good, pick somebody who's right, in an area, in a period when everything is fluid, is a very, very important, is very important advice. And I can easily see a situation in which there were, and we know historically, there were all kinds of people. I'm not going to call them charlatans, but let's call them people who really didn't deserve the status of being a Rav, that people should teach, that they should teach people. The way I understand it, and we'll see that, and it's true today is from a different point of view, I think very strongly that they're looking for quality control, which raises a couple of issues. Is how do you know? How do you know who to pick? I mean, I talked about creds, but people didn't have Harvard diplomas. People didn't have Yale diplomas, Hebrew University. But, I mean, there was no way of knowing. So how do you know who the person is? We're going to talk about that next week. Hopefully on Facebook Live at this point. But anyways. That's one question. And the other question is, when we're talking about picking a rabbi, you're talking about authority. And that raises an implicit question. The word Rav means master. That means you're putting yourself, put yourself in a subordinate position to somebody else. Now, up until 50, 60 years ago, that wasn't such an outrageous statement. But today, the very idea of having a Rav is deeply, deeply problematic for many people. The idea that my autonomy, the idea that I should accept the authority of someone else, even if I disagree because I don't understand or because I don't want to understand, whatever the case might be, is almost an anathema. And in fact, indeed, it is an anathema to many people. Because we are taught to think that we are totally autonomous, and who are you to tell me anything? One of the most egregious expressions of this, but there are certainly many others, is this idea of, well, that's my truth. Well, no, you can't have your own truth. You can't have your own facts. You can have your own opinion. But the question is there such a thing as expertise? Is this a person to whom you would defer? Now, if a bunch of you are thinking about the anti-vaxxers, hello, yeah, there we go. That's an example of an extreme example of this lack of desire to of this lack of desire, lack of ability to accept authority of any kind of authority. And that's exactly, again, it's against that that Rami Gamliel, and I would suggest even Yehoshua ben Prachya, are inveighing. Because the Torah is based on a mix of, it's a mix, but a mix of authority and independence. We'll talk about that more next week, I think. But the idea, we don't believe that everybody's autonomous. We are obligated from the get-go to do mitzvot, and there are demands made of us which are not always convenient, certainly not calories comfortable. And similarly, when it comes to study, we don't think that we can just make up our own minds and say, this is what it is. We are obligated to continue a chain of tradition, and how that expresses itself, how that manifests itself, again, is something else is another aspect we need to talk about. But there is this question of deference. Now, that doesn't mean you become a robot. We don't become a database. A database is stupid. Like books are stupid. There was we were once walking out of Shir, out of the class, and Rav Soloveitchik, somebody turned to Rav Soloveitchik, that's all, and said, Rebbe, the Sfarim say, the books say. And the Rav looked around him and gave him this withering look that only he could give, and said, books? Books don't say anything. Books are stupid. It depends what you do with them. There is room for creativity in a context, but the Rav gives you your value, but by having a Rav is stage one. Creativity comes later, and again, I hope to get to that. Like, as I said, this discussion is going to take us a while. But it's not just a question, but this question of autonomy and having a rabbi, having a master to whom you defer, it's not just a question of deference. It's not just a question, and the problem of our personal autonomy. It's also a matter of the fact that, and again, here we come back, here what happened at the beginning of the first millennium and what happens today really come together, and that's the question of quality control, although it actually comes from two different directions. What do I mean? As I mentioned, at the beginning, in the time of Rami Gamliel, the only way you could learn Torah Shebal Peh was by hearing and by imbibing the words of the Chachamim that they told you, literally told you. They recited to you past traditions and explained them and so on, and you would internalize them and then you would know them. And there were friends, and there were guys who had wonderful memories. You could ask them, what did he say 3 years ago? And he'd go, blah, 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 blah. Your friend would, who has a photographic memory or a perfect memory, would be able to repeat them. But you needed, they were the source of all your information, so you definitely needed a Rav. Okay, so that's why you need quality control. You don't go to some schlepper, you go to somebody who's good. Today, it's we're in the opposite situation. The opposite situation, but you'll see there's a similarity that come together. And the opposite situation where we live in the world of the information highway, wherein everything's available, ostensibly. Everything that we've ever written is available. I mean, it's awesome. Occasionally I take a look at my Bar Ilan Responsa project. It's not a CD anymore. It's a discount key. It's a flash drive. And I just understand that I just ordered actually the upgrade of the, of version 29 plus, which is everything that was ever, almost every sefer that was ever written in Chumash and Gemara and rabbinic literature and Zohar and Machshava and Chassidus and Responsa and also the entire encyclopedia, Talmudic encyclopedia online, and there are hyperlinks which connect the footnotes in the Encyclopedia Talmudic to the rest of anything they would have ever written. And it takes up this much space. Okay, so everything is available. Now, the fact that everything's available is a wonderful gift. By the same token, it is also a challenge and a danger. Because the fact that things are available and education and information is empowering, there's no question. also could lean to arrogance. What do I need a rabbi for? What do I need a master for? I've got it all right here. I'll just look it up. That's what, I'll look it up. And I know I'm my own rabbi. I know how to read Hebrew. I can now so much as in English, I can look it up in English, and I can make up my own mind, and that's it. And who are you to tell me anything? Comes Rabbi Gamliel, and comes Yeshua ben Prof, yeah, over an arc of 2,000 years, and say, hold your horses. Hold your horses. Information, data, is not enough. You've got to know how to crunch the numbers. You've got to know how to interpret the numbers. You've got to know which sources are authoritative and which ones aren't. You've got to know to see what the words really mean. And that takes massive, that takes a broad range of knowledge and also an ability to think in a certain way. Because you can apply different disciplines to different text, to the same text, and come up with totally different answers. Some of those approaches are legitimate as far as halakha is concerned, as far as Torah is concerned, some of them are not. And therefore, you need a rav. Selecha rav, because first of all, you should be humble. I'll talk about that too, but we have talked about it in the course of the, it's more than a number of many months that we've had this, we've gotten together. And at the same time, you should go to a master for quality control of you. And quality control in terms of what's important and what's not important and how to read and how not to read. The only way to be able to do that is to get off your high horse, recognize one of your deficiencies, recognize when you need training. Hopefully you'll get to the stage where you'll be able to be original. But at the beginning, the first thing is, just as 2,000 years ago you went to be able to hear the traditions themselves, now you need to go, say l'charav, and not to sit there and say, even if you had a yeshiva education, to sit there and say, oh, I need to know how to use this material. I need to know how to pick. I need to know how to use quality control. I need to know what the proper and deferential way to go about learning Torah is. And then you'll be able to, go about studying Torah properly and hopefully get onto the stage where you get to be a member of the Chachmei HaMasoret. Now, we haven't gotten to that yet. We will talk with Meretz Hashem next week about who is a Chacham HaMasoret. What does it mean to pick a master? What does it mean to pick a rabbi? What happens if a rabbi, what kind of criteria do you need to have a teacher, which is not a small business. But it's a beginning. It's a beginning. And hopefully by next week we will do this live. In the meantime, thank you for joining me. As usual, please, I would invite you to contact me either on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram or by email. I welcome your questions. I welcome your observations. Please share this if you like it, and let's get this community of ideas going. And I wish everybody two things. First of all, get vaccinated. There's a very important religious obligation to get vaccinated. And secondly, most importantly, have a wonderful Purim, no matter what the circumstances are, whether you're in a small group or a larger group or whatever the case might be. Enjoy, celebrate. We see the light at the end of the tunnel. And hopefully by Pesach, we'll go out from the darkness to the light into the redemption of family being together. And I look forward to seeing you next week.